I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
This podcast exists because of the paid members at decodingtv.com. Get access to ad-free episodes, early access to episodes, and bonus episodes at decodingtv.com. Thanks to all the decodingtv.com paid subscribers who make this show possible.
You said that your man was talking about predicting the movements of the sun. Mm. Nobody would make this game for something that boring. There has to be a bigger mission. There always is.
So? What's our mission?
Our mission, Jin Chung, is Jack Rooney getting his mortal revenge.
Just cut my head off again.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Decoding TV, a podcast about television. I'm David Chen. Joining me, as always, welcome back from vacation, Patrick Klepek.
Three bodies? I've already got enough trouble with one body, David.
Take my wife, please. I just flew in from Disney World, and boy, are my arms tired. Anyway, Patrick, welcome back.
I carried a four-year-old for an entire week. My arms are tired, my shoulders mostly.
Patrick was on vacation last week. He is now back. Welcome back, Patrick. Good to have you back. Of course, it was also great to have Jesse Earle on the show last week to talk about Shogun and Manhunt. So fun episode. But we're glad you're back because, Patrick, we got a lot of TV news to discuss today. We are also going to be covering the new Netflix original series, Three Body Problem. We've watched the first three episodes. We're going to be talking about that show. And we're also going to be talking about episode 6 of Shogun, which is airing right now on Hulu and FX. You can find more episodes of this podcast at podcast.decodingtv.com. Email us at decodingtv@gmail.com and find us across all platforms, Instagram, TikTok, Threads, at decodingtv. Patrick Klepek, we're also featured in new advertisements on Overcast right now. And if you're joining us from Overcast, welcome. All ones of you who have joined us for Overcast.
I love Overcast. I don't know that I go there for discoverability, though. I feel like Overcast is a power user sort of podcast app. Great one. Mm-hmm. One of the few apps I'm happy to pay for. I could probably pay for more of it, but they just took my money and said, that's enough. I was like, okay. Mm-hmm. All right, Overcast. Well,
This is the first of what I would say is a salvo of Decoding TV ads that's going to launch across many platforms, we hope. So if you're joining us for the first time, welcome. We talk about TV news. We review and recap the best shows on television right now. And we are happy to have you here. So thanks for joining us. All right. Let's talk about some of the stuff that's going on in the world of television to start with. Patrick Klepek, I was very excited to hear about this show. There's a new medical drama called The Pit, which is going to be show run by R. Scott Gemmill. I'm not 100% sure how to pronounce it, but John Wells is also going to be show running it, along with Noah Wiley starring. It's going to be a 15-episode series that focuses on frontline heroes in a modern-day Pittsburgh hospital. And that is extremely exciting for someone such as myself, because that's a lot of the team that put together the original ER that's going to be making a new medical drama for Max. Patrick Klepek, curious what your associations are with ER, the original NBC series.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but ER has a connection to Michael Crichton, right? The author?
Yeah. He was like one of the executive producers of that show. Yeah.
Right. And I believe that is my first connection to that show, because I watched Jurassic Park, formative experience for me as a kid, probably the movie I saw the most in the theater. And from there, I was like, well, where did this come from? Oh, it's based on a book from Michael Crichton. Just started devouring everything in the Crichtonverse, which eventually led me at one point to ER. That show didn't really end up hooking me in, but it's impossible to not have lived through the 90s and know the intro to that show and how just a like dominant,
the theme song you're talking about,
the theme right? song, yeah. like just it's just like it, what a dominant cultural force it was on, even as powerful and as big as television was at the time. ER still stood out as a titan in that era of television.
I think it was an extraordinary show. It's a show that felt like it presaged a lot of prestige TV, but it had, you know, deep characters whose arcs you followed from week to week, and yet each episode was individually consumable, had its own arc, and also they made freaking over 20 of these things a year. It was incredible.
Back in the era of, you know, be like, oh, how long I'm waiting between seasons of whatever show, even shows that are more less bombastic or expensive in nature, still take often years in between seasons. The idea that shows like ER or Lost or just this certain style of television, like they finished in May and then just started again in September. Now with huge breaks in between, I remember watching Lost and there used to be a website called, I forget what it was, but it was like, is the new episode of Lost new.com? And it was just yes or no, because they were trying to pad out seasons between September and May with the only break being in the summer.
Right, because if there's 22 episodes, that's not 20 weeks. That's more than 20 weeks. So there's weeks where you take a break and so on, right?
Right,
so,
and then you know, TV used to have, what was it called? It was called Sweeps Week, right? Where you'd often get like some of the most melodramatic, biggest cliffhanger moments.
Stunty things, a character dies, characters get married, stuff
what
like that.
What was the, right? I don't remember. I remember the name of it, but like, why was it Sweeps? Was it just like trying to coalesce a bunch of expensive advertising
I think it was because that was the week that advertising rates were determined, if I recall correctly, so it's like they want to attract the highest ratings for those weeks. But yes, this is how this is what TV used to be like in the pre-streaming age. We sound like freaking dinosaurs, Patrick Klepek. Anyway, but ER was an incredible show. Like, that is a show, Patrick Klepek, you go watch it today, it holds up extremely well. Not
I bet like I bet
it is still really amazingly shot. It still has really compelling characters. And I am really excited about The Pitt, which is going to be streaming on Max, the one to watch for HBO, and starring Noah Wiley. This should be really, really cool. And if you haven't yet, go back and give the original ER a try. Like, that's a great show to have on in the background or to just binge. I think it will reward your time. So
I'm just surprised it hasn't. Where does it live now on the internet?
It used to be on Hulu at some point. Right, because remember when like NBC used to be really deeply involved in the Hulu project? I think it's still there as we speak. You can watch the entire series of ER on Hulu.
It just feels like we've gone through so many cycles at this point of like this kind of show like finding its way to a younger audience, and then they all go like, holy hell, you know, like we've seen
that. Why is it Friends and not ER that's so popular with Gen Z? It's, you know.
Well, isn't it essentially it's not on Netflix? Like, is that like the easiest like explanation for?
Maybe it's also like not the lightest show. You know, it's
people
are dying every episode. People are dying or getting maimed every episode, right?
So I guess the other shows that have done this are, you know, Suits, Friends,
right. They're
Seinfeld,
like fun breezy shows, right? Yeah.
It's not like,
one week this character's dealing with cancer, another week...
Where's the Tiktonisance for ER, David, I ask you?
I agree. It should be there. The only other thing I want to mention is this is going to be a 15-episode series, and I've seen a lot of chatter online recently about how we used to be a society that made 20-plus long episode series, and it's weird. It is weird that is something that is better for the people making the show in some ways. It's very stressful, obviously, but like,
sure,
the actors and filmmakers get compensated better.
It's longer, right? You don't have to line up
like 3 gigs a year. You can just do 1 gig a year instead.
It's why you see like high profile actors that were on television shows. They would, you know, there would be a break in between in the summer where maybe you could sneak in a movie and then you're just right back to the production train for the television show in the fall.
But it's better for the filmmakers, it's better for the actors. People, the viewers want it, right? Like, there's a reason why shows like Suits really took off on Netflix, and a big part of it is because there were a lot of episodes. You could just put it on and watch it all summer. But the executives over at the Hollywood Factory have deemed, no, that's not how we're going to do things anymore. So, you know?
I have mixed thoughts on this. I think it has actually been deeply healthy for drama. So, like, certain styles of series would not benefit from being longer. You know,
agreed.
I just mentioned the show Lost. That's actually a show that
that if it was shorter, it would have been improved.
I think like it has enough like core storytelling. However, you feel about the flaw, but those flaws were exaggerated by the very nature of having to tell 20 plus episodes over the course of a season to pad an entire year of programming. And so, I think shows like that have been would benefit from having been developed during this era. You know, like I look at you know, even like a Game of Thrones, like is that show better, like, or like any of these sorts of like high profile dramas better for being twice as long? I think certain types of storylines that don't get to luxure, there's certainly the argument that so much of prestige television is so forward momentum because there's just not as much time for it to slow down, relax, and sort of luxuriate in a moment. But I think there's certain styles of shows, certain types of shows, tones of shows that would benefit from this. This certainly seems like one of them, where you can very much imagine it's a medical emergency of the week, and like here, you know, and you're weaving together a broader storyline over that arc. But I don't think that applies necessarily holistically to all television. Should suddenly would be improved if it was twice as long. Having more television is, I don't know if that's the issue that we're facing at the moment, David, but I certainly understand the sentiment.
That's fair. But I think there are certainly shows that would benefit from that. So I'll give an example. Rian Johnson's Poker Face on Peacock.
Sure.
You know, that's a show that you could totally have more episodes per year. That said, I think it is a high order of difficulty what they achieve with that show. So maybe not. But I do think it's sad that procedurals or weekly shows that have many, many episodes are still wildly popular, and we're just not making them very much anymore. You know,
well, but also the sort of the expectation of the audience is different for those types of shows. Like I know you're hoping The Pitt is good and that you have a profound reverence for ER and it was a good show, but also like your expectation episode to episode is like a little bit different when you have a relationship with a show that is over that many episodes. You know, I don't think you necessarily go into every episode going, well, every one of these is going to be a banger.
Well, like, I actually think that's a feature, not a bug. I think having more episodes means you can, hey, here's the wacky one where like side character goes on this whole other mission. That's
here's the musical episode.
Here's the musical episode. Here's the bottle episode. You know, like
we
used to have everything, Patrick Lepik. We used to have everything.
It's true.
Right.
It's true.
Anyway, well, speaking of people being available or unavailable to star in a show, I think you might have mentioned. Did I mess up that transition? Speaking of how many episodes a show should have,
yeah.
News broke this week about Euphoria season 3. I have to say, this news, the way it was rolled out, is very odd. For those who don't know, Euphoria is a high school drama that aired on HBO seasons 1 and 2. It is the fourth most popular show in HBO history, behind Game of Thrones, House of the Dragon, and Last of Us. So it is a big deal. It was created and written by Sam Levinson, and it helped to catapult many of its actors into the international spotlight. Zendaya, Hunter Schafer, Jacob Elordi, these are all actors whose careers they might not have necessarily been launched or created by, but they were certainly helped along in a massive way.
Is Sydney Sweeney not also in that show?
Oh yeah, Sydney Sweeney, exactly. Yeah, sorry. Yeah. I was just giving some examples, but I was not exhaustive.
I was just making sure I wasn't wrong. I was like, I'm pretty sure, like the it girl of the moment was also in that show.
That was not an exhaustive list, but yeah, Sydney Sweeney also definitely up there. And seasons 1 and 2 have already aired, and season 3 was supposed to be coming out, but has been quote unquote delayed. Now, HBO said that this has been delayed until 2025, and they are setting a target date of 2025, which is fine. But the thing that also broke is that they are allowing the stars to pursue other projects in the meantime, because apparently Sam Levinson still working on getting those scripts right. Sam Levinson, of course, also his last project did not go well. The Idol was a critical and commercial disaster. And so he is currently working on Euphoria season 3. Some people have asked, why isn't there a writer's room for Euphoria season 3? Wouldn't the show greatly benefit from that, both in terms of timing and content? And the answer is yes, but we don't know why. You know, I assume that it's Sam Levinson's decision to not have a writer's room for that show. So regardless, the reason why that's weird is because when you release a set of actors from their contracts and commitments, you basically make it so that it's going to be very difficult to pull all those actors back together for season three, right? Like, when usually in these contracts of like, hey, you are committed for a television season, there's actually like, my understanding of this is that there's actually like shows for which you are positioned. So like Euphoria is first position, and then there's like another show that's in second position and so on, indicating their priority levels. And when actors are released like this, they can go off and do anything. You know, Zendaya can go make Dune Messiah, right? Assuming she survived Dune Part 2, which I'm not going to say whether or not she did. But you know what I mean? Like, she can be, Sydney Sweeney can go make Anyone But You Part 2, still Anyone But Ewing. You know, like, people can go off and do other things. And it will. And these actors, it's not like these actors are wanting for work right now. They're all like...
They're all really on the ascent. It's, you know, that one of the rumors has been that The Bear is shooting seasons 3 and 4 back to back, partially as a response to, oh shit, like these actors are all about to take off in many different ways, partially because of that show, partially because they were on the ascent to begin with. But the idea being that how will we get them back for season 4 once like everything sort of takes off? And so they're trying to, like, hey, that'll give us 2 years of breathing room or finish the show. And I really feel like people should maybe prepare themselves for like Euphoria never coming back. Like, exactly. This really seems, especially I saw in that article, they're like, well, I know people liked that high school show. Wow, we can't really pull off that high school thing anymore. Certainly after high school. And as you know, David, all shows set in high school, when they transition to after high school, wildly successful, very easy transition. We'll just figure out those characters in a different venue and it'll be fantastic. It just seems like coming off the Idol.
So, I mean, everyone knows the legendary episodes of Saved by the Bell, the college years, right? Like, everyone loves that show. Everyone reveres that show as a classic.
I'd love to take the characters out of the environment that they were successful in and just do it somewhere else. Which is, you know, like, you know, I didn't watch The Idol.
Successful is a strong word for Euphoria in this context, but yes. I would agree with you. I think it is highly unlikely that this will be actually made. And that's why several publications are announcing it as Euphoria Season 3 put on hold indefinitely. If I had to bet money, and I am a betting man, this is true. It is, Euphoria Season 3, I think, is kaput at this point, which is...
I bet you get a movie, right?
Yeah, like,
you can sign enough paychecks to get people to come back for something that was... either a limited series or a film that allowed to bring the stories to some measure of conclusion. I bet you could wrangle people's schedules to do something like that. But that seems to did you. So I've wanted to watch this show. I chuckled ahead of us recording that some people have said, like, it's a great show, but Patrick, you have two daughters. Do you want like a horrifying look into your future? Worry about Euphoria. That's not going to put me off it. I've wanted to watch the show.
Patrick has many reasons to fear for his daughters. Euphoria is not going to make a dent in that.
No, it's not. The real life horrors are much worse than a television show. But how did you feel coming out of, I know season one was like wildly heralded, season two a little bumpier, but still broadly good or had really high highs. Did you want a season three, or how do you feel at the prospect of the show sort of wrapping up with where it ended?
Season one is really an incredible viewing experience. The filmmaking is just really, you feel there's so much energy. It felt like watching Paul Thomas Anderson's Boogie Nights for the first time, where you're like, oh my God, wow, this is like a bold new, like, you know, the way in which they're communicating the story is really incredible. And so I would still recommend season one just as a viewing experience. Season two, much more mixed for me, in my opinion. Some of the characters are really ill-served in season two, particularly Hunter Schafer. They change up the whole style. I think they shoot the entire season on film. So it looks very, like, season one is like crystal clear, sharp. Looks like it's shot on like Red or Arri Alexa or whatever super high res digital camera.
Did they make a big thing about shooting it on film, or they just did?
Yeah, it was a big deal. And so, season two shot on film still has some of the stylistic hallmarks of season one, but the big part is, like, I think they've really lost control of the storytelling in season two. And at the same time, as I say that, It also has one of the most incredible episodes of the entire show. And those who have seen season two will know exactly what I'm talking about. There's an episode that features, it's like told from Zendaya's character's point of view. And that's like the whole episode is just like one of like a day in her life. And that's an amazing episode. So it's like, I cannot completely discount season two. It has some really high highs, but a lot of low lows and more lows than highs. So I actually think it's fine to end it where they ended it, honestly. Like, I would rather it ended there than they come back for, like, a really, what I'm guessing would be a pretty rough third season based on what's happened over the course of the last few years.
Well, it sounds like nothing, I don't know how you felt about the idol, but unless you were a big champion of that, there's not much about Levinson's recent output that necessarily suggests, like, all right, course corrected,
season three. He has learned from his ways, and he knows he's very self-introspective, and he knows what he's doing wrong, and right, like nothing suggests that. Anyway, those are some thoughts on the possibility of Euphoria season three. One final story I wanted to talk about, Patrick Klepek. Pete Davidson calls it quits on Bupkis season two. The previously announced second season of the Peacock comedy will no longer happen, as the actor says, this part of my life is finished. I'm reading here from The Hollywood Reporter. Pete Davidson, so Bupkis was a show that aired on Peacock. It was based on Pete Davidson's life. And Pete Davidson said in a statement to The Hollywood Reporter, quote, "I've always seen Bupkis as a window into my life, since it is so personal and about my struggles and family. After nearly a decade of my personal life being in media, I wanted a chance to tell my story my way. Of all the work I've ever done, Bupkis is by far what I'm most proud of. I'm so grateful to Lorne Michaels, Broadway Video, Peacock, Universal Television, and the amazing cast and writers for helping me create something honest, funny, and heartfelt. I do also feel this part of my life is finished. I'm very excited for this next chapter and for you guys to see the work. Thank you to all who support me, for I am forever grateful," end quote. Now, this news was mostly received positively. I'm pretty torn about it myself, Patrick Klepek. I did not watch Bupkis, but Bupkis was greenlit for a season two. Apparently, shooting was scheduled to begin this summer. And on the one hand, I think that Hollywood as an industry needs to take mental health more seriously. And if Pete Davidson was saying, hey, this show was putting all this strain on me and making my life feel exposed, and therefore I didn't feel I could do it anymore, like, I think overall that's a good thing from a big picture perspective. But this also kind of sucks. Hundreds of people come together to make a show. Many of them rely on that income to live. And it sounds like they had already started scheduling shooting for the summer. So maybe people had already blocked it out of their schedules. By the way, very difficult for any show to get a season two renewal these days. Very rare for any show to even get made these days. And so he had a greenlit second season already in the already granted. And then just kind of like it seems like it was understood by all parties that they were going to make this season, and then Pete Davidson abruptly pulls out. I think it probably sucks for the people who were involved in the show. It sounds like Broadway Video, one of the people that helped him make the show, didn't find out about this news in the best way either. Like,
they were emailed according to the article, which is an interesting way to say nah to something
right.
So big.
It's just like, I don't know the full details, but it feels like this was not done in a cool way. And that doesn't sit right with me. And I'm honestly surprised more people aren't talking about that. All that said, Patrick Klepek, you are somebody who has spent quite a bit of time monetizing his personal life in different ways, including on this podcast, where you confess details of the many crimes you've committed over
it's
the
true.
Years.
It's true. Well, that's penance. I'm working through those traumas, David. Thank you for your space.
I did not watch Bupkis, but I did watch his King of Staten Island movie, and so I'm kind of familiar with the overall feel and the contours of Pete Davidson's life and kind of how he is choosing to represent in the public. But what did you think when you first read the story?
Yeah, I guess trying to put aside, obviously, the extreme amount of disruption that can occur as a result of a production stopping at not quite the last second, but certainly pretty abruptly in the process, as you pointed out. But I'm definitely sympathetic to the idea of the world responds to the more that you put out about your personal life. That is sort of, that's a lot of the dynamic these days, is the more you reveal about yourself and your traumas and your personal life, people connect to that. And in many ways, it can be a beautiful thing. But there's a fine line there. It can be dangerous. It can be easy to exploit the others in your orbit at the expense of whatever you're trying to accomplish. And so I had a certain amount of sympathy for reading. If I just take it at face value of someone who says, hey, for a long time, I've been using, when you use your life experiences, you're not just using your own, you're using those, like,
right,
what happened
loved,
to you was
your loved ones and your friends, you know?
Right. Yeah. Right. And this was something that, you know, especially once I had kids, I started giving much more thought to. You know, my wife didn't necessarily know everything she was signing up for when we got together, but we went on that journey together as adults, right?
Like
she,
right, right.
As I made a transition to being sort of an online personality in addition to being a reporter, that was something organically that we did sort of hand in hand, even if it was unexpected. But, you know, kids that you bring into a world, they didn't sign on to showing up to this broken right. world. And they certainly didn't sign on to necessarily having, you know, my experiences as a parent or things like that, then monetize, even if I'm trying to do that in a
right.
empathetic and a way to try and help other people. And so I've tried to draw pretty specific lines in the sand. Like, for example, with my kids, I don't use their names online. I don't
right.
put pictures of them
online.
I was
going to say, I think Patrick was overall very respectful of his children and their consent, right, of which they are not able to provide at this point, you know,
right.
and so yeah, you don't use names. I think you have a protected Instagram account where you, like, you don't share their
yep.
images publicly, and I really admire that. But at the same time, crossplay.news is about parenting and video games, and so
yep.
you do write in detail about your parenting experiences, and I think you try to strike a balance between. Right. Yeah.
Yeah, I do. It's like, you know, I use the phrases oldest and youngest, and that's how I like talk through my kids. And there are times
right.
where I've written articles where I've spiked it halfway through because this feels too personal to like an experience that I went through or my child went through. And so it's a fine line. I'm not always going to be successful at it, but I just reading this, I can understand, you know, an artist reaching a point where it feels like you can sort of get tired of like re-exposing yourself to the
yep.
world to
totally.
Work through those feelings. And if that's truly what ended up happening here, and I take the statement at face value, I can certainly understand why at a certain point that can be a little exhausting.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I hope people don't hear my comments as being not understanding of
this. No.
But at the same time, it's also like, yeah, there's production realities and people work on these shows, and I wonder what was done to respect and honor them as well in this situation.
Right.
You know?
I would have yeah. different considerations. You know, I'm considering three direct people in my life, my wife, my two children,
yeah.
and the people orbit around that. This is a slightly different thing where you've got a whole television and an apparatus around it. So I can be sympathetic to what might have happened here, but also those considerations are different once other people's livelihoods are involved. So there's definitely that to it as well.
Indeed. All right. Well, anyway, those are a bunch of the television news stories that happened over the course of the last week.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
Since 2013, Bombas has donated over 100 million socks, underwear, and T-shirts to those facing homelessness. If we counted those on air, this ad would last over 1,157 days. But if we counted the time it takes to make a donation possible, it would take just a few clicks. Because every time you make a purchase, Bombas donates an item to someone who needs it.
Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
It's time to get to the part of the show where we discuss and recap and review a lot of the TV shows that are on the air. This week, we're going to be discussing Three Body Problem, which is on Netflix, and also Shogun Episode 6. I do want to let people know what our plan is for next week. We're going to be covering the next episode of Shogun. We're going to keep doing that until we get to the end of the series. We are also probably going to be doing an episode, like a bonus episode about Constellation, which just finished running on Apple TV Plus. So that's going to be our plan for next week, just so people know what to expect. All that said, Patrick Klebnik, let's talk about Three Body Problem.
Someone or something is targeting scientists.
They're going after our best and brightest. There's someone behind everything. You just have to dig. Whatever it is, it's watching and listening.
All right, Three Body Problem is the new series from the creators of Game of Thrones, David Benioff and D.B. Weiss. All 8 episodes are streaming right now on Netflix, and we have watched the first 3. We are going to give our overall thoughts really quickly at the beginning, then we're going to talk about some of the events that happened in the first 3 episodes of the show. But Patrick Klebnik, before we get into the show, just worth pointing out, the show's kind of a big deal. You know, this is a big bet. From Netflix. It cost around $20 million per episode. Game of Thrones, one of the most popular television shows of all time. And this is those creators' big follow-up to that. One of the shows that they've showrun since then. And so, it's a big bet. It's hugely ambitious, obviously based off of the set of novels that has become an international sensation. So let's talk about what we thought about the show. Patrick Klebnik, should people watch Three Body Problem in one sentence or less? What do you think?
Contact, X-Files, Independence Day, alien invasion contact narratives are one of my all-time favorite setups. It is the you just put that in front of me and I am going to feast. And so I don't know where Three Body Problem is going. We've only watched the first 3 episodes, but I find it set up really intriguing. I find the characters interesting. I'm a little mixed on the game format and how it's presented, and I'm sure we'll talk about that. But on a very basic level, like putting aside the prestige, putting aside the cost, I am really enjoying this as a sci-fi premise, and I am fascinated to see if it can land any of its big ideas in a meaningful way. Too early to say, but it's enough that I want to see what the answers are or what's left in the rest of the first season.
I wish I could be there with you, Patrick. I want to be there with you. And there's a lot of people online who I respect who really love this show.
Yep.
I cannot say I'm among them. I think that the show has some really interesting ideas and a handful of interesting visuals. But overall, I found it to be somewhat poorly realized as a gripping sci-fi story. But I will say, if you are a hardcore sci-fi fan, if you're a hardcore fan of those kinds of stories that Patrick said, I do think you will enjoy this. And so that's who I'd recommend this to. But other folks, I don't know as much. And I will try to articulate some of my issues with the show in this next segment. So those are my thoughts. Didn't like it as much. But if you're a hardcore sci-fi fan, I think you'll find things to enjoy. All right? Let's talk about some of the stuff that happens in the first 3 episodes. Now, this is a sprawling show that takes place across multiple time frames and multiple characters. And so I'm going to try to like summarize this as best I can. I do want to offer this other overall thought, Patrick Klebnik, before we begin, which is that I'm struck by how unfavorably Three Body Problem compares to Shogun. These are both hugely ambitious TV shows with tons of characters epic sweeping visuals and really big weighty themes. And Shogun and Three Body Problem both originated with stories that were highly culturally specific. Shogun leaned into that and said, hey, we're going to have a show that's like 80%+ subtitled and in a different language and obviously takes place in a different time frame. And also, by the way, we're going to do a lot of our shooting outside and on elaborate, intricate sets. I'm sure they use CG as well. You know, I'm not denying that. But you can tell that a lot of real physical work went into what they did on that show. Mm-hmm. Three Body Problem feels the opposite to me, right? Where in, you know, if you're familiar with the book, they basically took characters that were Chinese and made them all different races, which is like, okay, I understand why you may want to do that, but it's just striking the difference between...
Better than making them all white, but not necessarily yeah. the path you have to choose. You know what I mean?
You're right, Patrick. We could have, they could have definitely gone that way.
They did this in the 90s. We know which path they would have gone.
This could have been like the Alive movie, you know, a version exactly. of Three Body Problem. But and
that's
then
progress,
I think,
David. That's progress. You know, you got it. You got
to
mark it.
Thank you, Patrick. I'll be sure to note that. The other thing is that I think a lot of the show doesn't look very good. I think a lot of it looks like it was shot on the volume.
Ooh,
and
$20 million. Where? I mean, that is genuinely shocking to hear. I was unaware of that number until mm-hmm. I started doing some reading on the show after having watched the first. Because I wouldn't describe the show as cheap looking.
It doesn't look bad, but it doesn't look, you know.
It's one of those things where watching it, I wasn't thinking about the visuals. It's not a, maybe I was in more of the gaming
I was, because I think sometimes they looked pretty bad. But overall, it's fine. Like it's
fine. It just, fine, if you were to tell me $20 million per episode approaching... Well, actually, frankly, more expensive than many of the episodes that were produced for Game of Thrones toward the end of its run, where many of the episodes were just by sheer setup of plot had to be absolutely epic in scope and what it was depicting. And this is somehow more, you know, the volume was supposed to make things like more effective and cheaper. And it just seems like we've also gone. I don't know how to explain how shows can seemingly cost so much and. You used to be able to joke about, well, you see the money on the screen. It's right. I don't.
You don't really see it on the screen in this show. Again, there's some things that look really good, but some things look really bad. And
it just looks like a TV show.
Ends up being really mixed. It ends up seeming really mixed to me. Okay. Yeah. Well, so at the end of the day, I'm struck by how like this one show, in my opinion, Shogun, is just so much more successful at what it's trying to achieve than Three Body Problem.
Yeah.
And I'm struck by like, some of the decisions that they made to achieve those things. Those decisions could be coincidental or not, but it is something that that I think about when I watch both these shows. All right, let's talk about some of the stuff that happened. So I will try to condense the events into like three or four separate plots, but obviously I'm not going to be able to get everything. The first plot line takes place in 1960s China. In the opening scene, a professor named Ye Zetai is accused of teaching the Big Bang Theory. Which, as anyone who watches television knows, you should never talk about. he is then executed. His daughter, Ye Wenche, is then sent to work in a labor camp. She is caught reading Silent Spring, an environmental science book, and taken to division headquarters and asked to sign a statement implicating more of her father's colleagues or else risk further extreme punishment. But before she can do that, she's taken to a place called the Red Coast Base, which can use her particular set of skills. She's a skilled scientist, and we basically discover Red Coast Base wants to make China the first country in the world to make contact with an alien species. Later, in episode 3, Ye Wenche does make contact with one of the aliens, and even though they say, don't contact us back, she says, come on, come on, aliens, come invade us.
This place is pretty bad. Like, how can that be any worse?
You know, yeah, and you know, Ye Wenche has had a pretty tough life, and so we understand why she would make that decision. A few Chinese-related comments I want to make before we talk about like what actually happened here. I did send the screenshot of the opening scene to my parents and asked them to translate what was on those banners in the opening scene.
Oh.
And my dad sent back the translations. One of the banners says, renovate the party and build the party, One of the banners says, abandon the old and adopt the new. One of them says, eradicate the old world. One of them says, establish the new world. So there you go. There's some Decoding TV exclusive info here for you about what was on those translations. I also want to say, anytime a white person speaks Chinese in this show, it's god awful. It's not. I think, you know, if you're not Chinese and you watch it, you're like, ooh, wow, they know how to speak Chinese, the foreign language.
I wasn't watching this in Boston on my iPad going, ooh, ow. But I will say,
I was directly speaking to Patrick at that moment, but yeah, it's
wow, just a targeted attack from space.
But yeah, I will tell you that
ignorance is bliss, though. That's what I will say. Like, the ignorance is bliss in the sense that to not know allows you to probably, forgive, to look past something that for you, I have to imagine, like, might have been a little more grating.
Well, I think the effect on the viewer is supposed to be, oh, wow, ooh, look at this guy. He can speak Chinese. But for me, I'm like, wow, that's some of the worst. Like, I don't speak Chinese particularly well, but it's way better than anything you hear on the show. The words are correct, but the intonation is all over the place. It's in general, pretty bad. So anyway, that's just some Chinese commentary.
Well,
for
you. But I mean, to build on that and your previous comparison, it's impossible not to look at a show like Shogun in comparison to this, where, you know, choosing to cast like predominantly like Japanese actors speaking like fluent Japanese, like there are.
But it's supposed to, you know, the analogy in that show would be, why aren't they speaking Portuguese for real?
Sure.
Right?
Sure.
But because it's the white characters that are speaking the Chinese that's bad in this show, you know, so.
Right. But they could have found characters who could, they could have been actors who could have done that. What I mean is,
broadly speaking. Or had actors spend literally more than 10 minutes figuring out how to say the words in Chinese correctly. You know,
I guess my broader point is like, Shogun is thinking very deeply about its use of language. And I think part of what you're getting at here is that it's being a little flippant about its use of language in a way that is not necessarily as respectful and as engrossing as it could be given what it's trying to present.
Who knows how it all went down? You know, like maybe the white dude said the thing and then they clearly had a bunch of Chinese people on set and no one wanted to say to David Benioff and D.B. Weiss, psst, hey, that guy's Chinese sucks. You know, like, no.
Let's just ADR it later. You know, like, come on.
Yeah, or it's good enough. You know, like, who knows? Anyway, all right. If you are Chinese and you disagree, by the way, feel free to comment at decodingtv.com or email me at decodingtv@gmail.com. But I was like, I think it's one of the characters, Evans is the one that speaks Chinese, right? When he's young. And I'm like, wow, that is rough. If the only time I've heard rougher is when Ethan Hawke spoke Chinese in the Disney Plus original series Moon Knight. I don't know if you remember watching Moon Knight.
He did do that.
And it was like, and he spoke Chinese, and it was literally incomprehensible. Like, I literally could not understand what, it was not recognizable as Mandarin. Okay, anyway. We're off on a tangent. Patrick Klepek, what did you think of the stuff that took place in 1960s China?
Certainly the way it's shot is very striking. I thought it was I know nothing about the novels, the premise of the show, other than broadly speaking that it is a like alien contact narrative. And so to have the show situate itself so solidly in the past, and then of course, as the show, you know, goes on through its opening, three episodes, we are constantly revisiting this era. It is not just, hey, here's a flashback to one specific moment in time, we're never going to revisit it. The show is obviously solidifying this moment in time is very important to that kind of the ripples of the present and probably what will continue to play out through the course of the narrative of the season. I found it all very shocking, very striking. I'm not, you know, intimately familiar with that like period in Chinese history. And so I can't speak to like the authenticity of sort of like the emotions of the moment or what it's trying to depict. But for a show that is a show about aliens are going to visit. I was like, oh, okay. Like, this is a pretty striking way to begin. This seems to have on its face nothing to do with what humanity's response to, you know, contact from an extraterrestrial beings would be like. But it certainly grabbed me by the collar to start. If this is what it's saying is important to the beginning of this particular narrative, this particular interaction with aliens.
Yeah, I think it's also just good to see, you know, this took place during the Mao, the Cultural Revolution took place during the Mao era, and I think it's actually good to see a depiction of what a repressive regime is like. I think that's just not very common in media in general, I think. And also to know what we want to try to avoid here in America. You know, like, I think that's it's useful from an object lesson perspective. So I really thought this was all pretty well done. This is actually probably some of the strongest material on the show, in my opinion, was the Ye Wenche stuff and how she's just in a terrible situation. You know, her father is executed, and then she needs to go work, and then she's like, hey, you might be in an even worse situation. Her significant other freaking hangs her out to dry, which is pretty rough. Not a great depiction of Asian male courage there, right? When
I constantly found myself wanting to spend more time in this era of the show. I find the dynamics, like, I think there's a lot of characters we're juggling as we get to sort of the present day stuff, and I don't find any of them as singularly interesting as this one character set in 1960s China. I would have been, you know, again, I have no familiarity with the adaptation happening here, and like whether what it's choosing to highlight or not highlight is like how that fits within the puzzle pieces of the original narrative of the trilogy of novels. But just taken as like the show in front of me, more often than not, I was thinking to myself, I certainly would have been more interested in the structure of this show that was maybe leaning heavier on this and then had a big jump cut later to the present that sort of dealt with the consequences, because I just feel like there's a lot of left on the table in terms of what's so interesting about what this particular character is going through. And often it feels like, well, we're jumping back there mostly for a plot reason. We got to like explain something more that's happening back here in the present. And I think that's a little unfortunate, because that world is just so, well, like you said, we don't see it depicted very often. And so this version of the present, I've seen versions of this many times before. I've seen people contact it.
Seen stuff in the present, Patrick?
But any sort of alien contact narrative, I've watched so many movies, television shows that have done versions of this. I haven't seen versions of this done juxtaposed against the Cultural Revolution. It's just an interesting place for a story like that to be set. And I'd be far more fascinated to spend more time there than the show is interested in doing.
I do think it's interesting that a lot of conservatives love this show. They are saying, this is what happens when communism. That's not completely unfair, but also this is also what happens when science is not valued, you know, when we live in an era of anti-intellectualism, you know, and that arguably is a stronger animating path than communism to get where we got at the beginning of this show. So
agreed.
I think lessons for all to be found in this series. So yeah, we agree the 1960 China stuff, really compelling. Probably looks, you know, in terms of how it actually looks, it probably like looks the most compelling. It looks like they actually shot some of this stuff outdoors and on these intricate sets. So at the Red Coast base. So I really liked the stuff that took place in the 1960s. Now, of course, we're spoiling the first three episodes, so I will say that Ye Wenche does survive until the modern day. It's a big reveal that she is Vera's mother. Character played by Rosalind Chow in the modern day era. So who, as of the first three episodes, is not really a major character yet. So we'll find out what her role is going to be in the days to come, or the episodes to come. In the present day, five friends start encountering strange phenomenon that's generally triggered for them by the suicide of a scientist named Vera Ye. There's Augustine Augie Salazar, played by Isaac Gonzalez, who starts getting visions of an ominous countdown and is told to shut down her nanofiber research or else. There's Saul, who has kind of a vague romantic history with Augie, who used to be a brilliant scientist, but now spends most of his time drinking and trying to hook up with women. There's Will Downing, a physics teacher who gets pancreatic cancer, and that's most of his storyline for now. And there's Jack Rooney, a Playboy-esque figure who got rich off of a snack food empire. We'll also talk about Jin Cheng and her role in a moment. But Patrick Klepek, I am curious. This is one of the biggest changes from the book. In reality, like in the book, these five characters are kind of derived from one character in the first book and also from characters in future books, right?
Interesting.
And they're kind of mesh them in into this one group of people. And so I'm curious, did this work for you? They're called the Oxford Five because they're kind of like, these are the five people that are critical to the plot that's unfolding right now. What did you think of the Oxford Five, and did you find any of these characters compelling?
It feels so early to say, like, they're compelling enough is what I will say, right? Like, this is part of what has led me to be interested just broadly in the mysteries that the show is presenting in front of me, especially as someone that does not know where any of this goes in the books. I'm fascinated to find out how this version of an alien narrative, so like communication narrative or invasion narrative, unfolds. And so there's not much to any of these characters this far in, but I also don't hold that against the show too much at three episodes. That's, you know, maybe that's something that would, like, would it shock me if I got to the end and it's like, ah, these were a lot of convenient, you know, plot device characters meant to move the puzzle pieces along. No, that wouldn't shock me. I could certainly see that arc for these characters if they remained as sort of surface level as they are. But I think there's so much heavy lifting in terms of just getting the broad premise. Like, there's a, behind the scenes, originally you and I talked about watching the first two episodes. Then you dove in because I was out of town and said, hey, I think it actually makes a lot of sense to watch the first three episodes because it really feels like the first three are establishing,
right,
broadly speaking, kind of a pilot. Like, this is what the show, like, if you were to put the title card at the end and it said Three Body Problem, right, like, it feels like that's what's sort of happening at the end of the third episode. And so I'm willing to give the show a little bit of rope because it feels like pieces are just being arranged on the board for the show to then dive in to some of the messier philosophical science character problems that are set up. So it works enough, but I'm not necessarily going to sit here and sing the praises of any of these particular characters. Obviously, Augie is sort of the focus because of the fact that she is sort of picked to be someone who is cursed with this countdown that is in her visions.
What did you think of the countdown, by the way, Patrick? Because apparently, from the book, it's supposed to be terrifying. And
is it terrifying if they show it every 30 seconds? You know what I mean? Like, I understand what they're going for, which is, do you think she's not seeing it now? She's seeing it now. Do you think she's not seeing it now? She's seeing it now. Look, it's, I don't know how the, I would be interested to read a passage from the book that described what they're trying to visualize. I can't imagine it is difficult. If we're just take away how the book describes it, it's just, hey, numbers. Spooky, in your face. That just seems like a difficult thing to pull off. The problem is the way I'm not a filmmaker, I'm not a scriptwriter, but the way I might do that, if it's like, dude, this is really hard to make, like, the numbers seem scary, maybe don't show me all the time, because the answer was like we couldn't make them that scary. But like, this is what we came up with. Do you want to see it all the time? It's like, no, not really. Just let the actor, who's totally fine, I'm not blown away by her performance, but she's totally, I think, competent with the material put in front of her. Let her reaction to being surrounded by this instill me with imagination of what that horrifying must be, because instead the show is just constantly like, she looks a little scared. You want to see it? Oh, it's not that scary. Damn, we shouldn't have shown it to him. Next time we'll get him. Next time we'll get them. And that, I feel like the show, I get the show is convinced it's showing you what is scary. It's not spooky. It's just not as scary as the show is conveying. I imagine you fell into a similar sort of pattern with it.
Well, speaking more generally about the Oxford Five, counterpoint to what Patrick is saying, the characters are bad and you should feel bad, Patrick. you're saying, yeah, I mean, we're three episodes in and not a single one I give a shit about, but you know what? That's okay. I'm sure it's going to get better from here.
I'm okay. Here's the thing. I'm okay with high concept sci-fi having lackluster characters. Like, that is that you mentioned at the top, hey, the hardcore sci-fi people might get something out of this differently. And look, much like horror, sci-fi is a genre that often is better at its high concept ideas than it is at pairing that with compelling characters. The best versions of that, look, if you've never seen Contact, if you watch this, you're like, gee, I love this idea. Go watch Contact. Contact is my all-time favorite. Like,
you're saying, Patrick's saying, we already have a good version of this story.
We do.
You don't need another good version. You don't need another good version of this. I think the characters are mostly really irritating.
Okay.
Like that's kind of their primary characteristic. There is a Reddit post on the Three Body Problem subreddit entitled, "This is written from a woman who loves women but hates poorly written female characters."
Okay.
Augie. Okay. And this person writes on Reddit, "The writers went out of their way to continuously show Augie emasculating Saul, I guess in an attempt to make her seem strong. But for me, she only came off as an entitled, ungrateful, rich a-hole who had everything handed to them the moment they wanted it. A second time she calls Saul, wakes him up in the middle of the night, telling him to come over. Might I remind you, they are not together. Despite being with another woman at the time, Saul drops everything for Augie, tells her he's on his way, but that's not enough for Augie. Nope. She hears the woman he's with in the background and hangs up on him after demanding he come to comfort her. She constantly treats him like crap, like he was beneath her, and Saul was really the king of simps for letting Augie treat him like a nuisance slash child when he showed up for her time and time again," end quote. Augie's not the only annoying one, though. I mean, Saul barely has any characteristics at all other than he likes, you know, drinking and partying, which is like, who doesn't? And Jack Rooney, just like overall kind of an irritating character who at the end of the third episode makes what, in my opinion, is an inexplicable decision to not find out more about what these people are selling. They've designed what, in his opinion, is one of the most advanced headsets ever known to mankind. And he's like, oh, yeah, whatever. These guys are kooks. They have no idea what they're talking about. It's just like, what? I don't even buy that as his decision at that point in time. The Oxford Five suck. That's kind of my position on it. Will Downing, I know nothing about him. So he has pancreatic cancer. I wish him the best.
I wish this fictional character the best. Hope it works out for you, buddy.
but I don't know anything about him.
Gives him nothing to do except just be sick and sad.
Except he's sick so far. And then Jin Chang is cool, and we'll talk about her in a bit. But yeah, in general, this is hugely unsuccessful as a set of major characters for me.
It's fascinating to compare this to Game of Thrones, because Game of Thrones, high concept fantasy show, what does it get right off the bat? Like, compelling characters that you care about. So as the fantastical elements ramp up, you don't lose sight of that. Here, there is such a deep emphasis on the high concept part of it, and the characters don't back that up. And then for me as the viewer, to some degree, it's how much do these particular high concept ideas work for you? How much are they carrying you relative to the lack of character work? And so I don't even necessarily disagree with your interpretation or reaction. I just find, as someone who enjoys these types of narratives, I wonder if someone has a different version of what does humanity do when they encounter an alien species? It just doesn't rise to the level of irritating me. Part of the reason, because what I'm coming for is, it sure would be nice if they had better characters, but I don't really care that much if they get there. Because for me, the satisfaction is the alien narrative. And if the characters get there, great. If it's a clever spin on Alien Contact, we've already met my threshold for what is interesting in these narratives. And
all right.
I use that as a comparison to something like horror, because that is often what I'm experiencing in that's my other sort of genre that I'm often playing around in, is hey, hope has got some interesting ideas. Characters, they'd be great, but that's not usually what I'm getting here. And then when you get both, you get something like Game of Thrones. I'm not confident they're going to get there yet, but it hasn't rise to the level of, gee, I wish these characters are better. Nothing about this show works for me, which it sounds like you got to at a very accelerated rate. You also want the aliens to invade and end everything. No, just come. Just come. These characters don't mean anything. Let's end this show. Season two? No way.
Let's talk about Jin Chang, who is gifted a strange Apple Vision Pro-like headset that used to belong to Vera. A lot of the first few episodes involves her playing the game, which we later learn is a recruitment tool that's being overseen by Mike Evans, a mysterious billionaire that may have his own intentions for what's going on. Later on, Jack Rooney also joins her in the game. Now, Patrick Klepek, I have to say, I found this game stuff to be indecipherable. I found solace in the Wikipedia description of the game derived from the book. So okay. I'm going to read that so people know what we're talking about here. So the game portrays a planet whose climate randomly flips between stable and chaotic eras. During chaotic eras, the weather oscillates unpredictably between extreme and cold heat, sometimes within minutes. The inhabitants, who are portrayed as having human bodies, seek a way to predict chaotic eras so they can better survive. Unlike humans, they have evolved the special ability to dehydrate themselves, turning themselves into a roll of canvas. They do this in order to lie dormant when the chaotic eras occur, saving valuable resources that otherwise would have been wasted. A second individual is required to rehydrate their body, as self-rehydration is not possible. Characters resembling historical figures, including Aristotle, Mozi, and Isaac Newton, fail to produce a model for the planet's climate as multiple civilizations grow and are wiped out by large-scale disasters. Jin ultimately realizes the planet is part of a system with three suns, whose distances from the planet, and thus their appearance and disappearance in the sky, are stochastic and hard to predict. When two suns are far away and the alien planet orbits the third, the climate enters a stable era. When the planet is too close to two suns, the climate is disrupted, causing a chaotic era. If it's close to all three suns, a planet-wide firestorm occurs. If all three suns are distant, the planet enters an ice age. Eventually, at a future time impossible to predict, the alien planet will collide with one of the suns and be consumed. The game shows the aliens building and launching colony ships to invade Earth, believing that the stable orbit will allow unprecedented prosperity and let them escape the destruction of their planet, end quote. I think that was all covered in the show, I think. There might be like one or two details that were outside the scope of what...
But quite broadly speaking, I think that's
broadly speaking, that, you know, I'm just worried about spoilers for you, but like, I think that was largely what was it. Patrick Klepek, you are... literally one of the top gaming experts in the world.
That's unfortunate. Apologies.
What did you think of how this show depicted its gaming sequences?
Oh, I hate it. I hate it. But I hate every piece of media that does this. I don't think it's possible to do particularly well. I think it is. I'm trying to think of like the best instances I can imagine remember of like games incorporating or movies incorporating video games is when they just incorporate actual video games as opposed to trying to recreate the experience of what a video game is and there's just, again, I haven't read the book. I don't know how it depicts it. Maybe it's easier in text for you to imagine what it might work. But here, it's just cheesy. Like, it's just impossible to take seriously. Every time we're in the game, I leave... get out of the game. I don't take the helmet off. You know, and we got to sort of an explanation of why we're in the game. That's fine. But like all I'm rooting for is, well, I hope the rest of the show doesn't spend a significant amount of time in the game. David, I have a strong suspicion the rest of the show is going to significant amount of time in the game. You know, the moment they put it on the first time, it was like level one. It's like, oh, shut the fuck up. That's not even how games are depicted. You're trying to depict like a God of War third person action adventure style thing. Those games don't do.
Level one. You don't say level one at the beginning of God of War anymore.
And I don't also want them to put up the like gaudy UI with like a mini map in the corner and like quest markers with compass. Like that one. I think it's incredibly challenging to depict what they are trying to do, which is to drop in real life actors into a highly realistic depiction of a virtual world. That is just, look, man, Steven Spielberg tried to do it with a flawed book. Ready Player One is trash. Like, it's a trash book. It's a trash movie. It's hard to do. Spielberg can't do it. Stop trying. And so I just fundamentally think you are...
you object to the premise.
I object to the premise, but I also understand I'm so engrossed in video games. Like, it is so part of how I think about the universe. I spend so much time in them as someone who studies and reports on and talks about the medium. How that works for other people, like a general populace who's just, video games are a normal part of their diet, a thing they do occasionally, as opposed to having built a career around. Maybe that doesn't rise to the same level of irritation. So it doesn't work for me. Once we're in it and they're dropping less of the gamey stuff, it's fine. It just feels like we're in, this is where, it feels like this is where they spent a lot of the money in the show. And I can't see it. It's like, this is where it's like, hey, you're going to take me to a far off land. At least make it seem visually interesting and arresting to look at. And I just don't think this show accomplishes that. So it kind of fails as a depiction of a game and as a like imaginary alien landscape. It's also just not that interesting or compelling to look at.
I think it fails on every level. It fails from a visual perspective, as you've indicated. I think also just the ideal is you as the viewer feel like, oh, I'm playing the game with these people, right? That's why game shows are popular, because you are playing along with people, right? And so ideally you're like, oh, I'm part of this problem solving as well. And first of all, I can barely even comprehend what problem is being asked of. Like, basically, what I'm saying is there's no way the viewer could have gotten to where the characters got to. Nowhere even close, in my opinion. And that to me indicates that this has completely failed. So not a fan of the game stuff. But anyway, they tried. There's also obviously a subplot in this show where there's a detective named Clarence, played by Benedict Wong.
Oh, he's great.
He's great. He's trying to uncover the situation along with his boss, Thomas Wade, played by Liam Cunningham. So that's also another thing that's going on. But Patrick Klepek, we're getting to the end of our conversation here. Any other thoughts or anything else you want to point out about Three Body Problem before we wrap up our first chat about the show?
Well, we breeze past it just there, but I love Benedict Wong. Amazing actor. Anytime he shows up in something, I'm always just delighted just to able to balance between dramatic and comedic and it's just an expressive face. Just somebody that, like, the moment I see that in a cast, I am just immediately more interested in watching it because to have him have a more like a meatier kind of straight role where he's not, it seems like a lot of times he's been cast after kind of getting popularized by a lot of like being a sidekick in the Doctor Strange films. It's like, like he's so funny, and he is, he's very funny, but it's fun to see him play just sort of this kind of weird dirtbag cop that's been fired from a bunch of different places. And there's a different version of this show that I kept imagining in my head as I was watching it, which was, what if way less more of the Oxford Five, as you called it, way more of the...
Did you say way less more? You mean way...
Well, no, way less of the Oxford Five, more of the era in China, of 1960 China, way more of Benedict Wong piecing together, like using 1960 China as a way to like give the audience a little bit more than what the characters in the present have. But it's largely a story of Benedict Wong trying to realize, why are all these physicists and like high level scientists killing themselves? And we're getting like little details of how we would arrive at something like that through the lens of this very different landscape, 1960s China. And like, again, I'm not trying to rewrite a show that doesn't exist and rewrite a book that had its own narrative, but the strengths, if I'm looking at the strengths of the show, the stuff I responded to the most as I was watching, it was whenever we were doing the sort of the detective stuff and whenever we were sitting in 1960s China.
Yeah.
And the show is just so much more interested in the Oxford Five, and the game stuff, right? The game stuff.
Yeah.
It is not as though like, hey, this is a plot device that we're going to dance around. It is central and key, and it is a huge part of the visual storytelling. And I just don't think that stuff is particularly strong, and the other stuff is at least stronger. And I just kind of found myself doing my own three body problem of trying to rearrange the pieces of this show into one that I think would have been stronger given its core elements that are in front of me.
Agreed completely. I actually don't think we disagree that much about the show anymore. And I think those are also the things that work the best for me in the show, and we'll see how the rest of the show evolves. So, Patrick Klepek, question for you. We're going to start ending our segments this way. I'm going to ask Patrick Klepek, is this a show we're going to continue watching week to week and recapping on the show, on the podcast, I should say? Is this a show we'll keep watching and recap at some point in the future, or are we going to stop right now?
We're not going to stop. We're also not going to do it next week. It's right in the middle there.
Yes.
We're gonna watch the rest of it and revisit it 2 weeks from now. We've had a chance to kind of, you know, let everyone sit with it as well. Yeah. And I think it will be worthwhile to see how quickly we get like any sense of a renewal, given how expensive some of the discourse around the viewership of the show. This is a very interesting pivot point for Netflix as a company as well, and what it represents. And so I think giving this show time to marinate for us, for the audience, and also what it means in the television culture, I think 2 weeks is a good spot to revisit kind of where we're at with Three Body Problem.
All right. Those are some thoughts on Three Body Problem. We'll be back in a couple of weeks with more thoughts on the entire first season of the show. Patrick Klepek, before we move on, you want to let people know where they can find more of your work on the internet this week?
They can find me talking about video games for as long as I've done it over at remapradio.com. And then also I have a parenting and gaming newsletter called Crossplay at crossplay.news, where I'm doing a lot of writing and reporting, honestly, from the recent trip I did to Disneyland. I just did a piece that I'm very proud of, kind of unpacking sort of how Super Nintendo World works relative to Nintendo's own design problems that it has in terms of being something that posits as being family friendly for everybody, but isn't actually always the case, and some of those design problems actually extend right into their theme park design. So if you want to read thoughts on that as I explore that more in the days and weeks to come, you can do that at crossplay.news.
And I want to give a shout out for decodingtv.com. if you enjoy this podcast, please consider becoming a paid member at decodingtv.com. Get ad-free episodes, early access episodes, and in the near future we'll probably have some announcements about how we're going to be doing bonus episodes at decodingtv.com, and I think it's going to be something people who are paid subscribers will really appreciate. So if you enjoy the podcast, consider supporting us, decodingtv.com. Let's get to our conversation about Shogun Episode 6.
The time has come for us to turn towards Torunaga as an ally.
Tuesday.
Alright, let's talk about Shogun Episode 6, Ladies of the Willow World. Let's start by talking about our overall... Actually, you know what? Before we get to the episode, I do want to acknowledge some feedback that's come in from previous episodes. Dylan from Portland, Oregon wrote into decodingtv@gmail.com. Hey David, just wanted to write in about a comment you made at the end of your discussion about the last Shogun episode. You were talking about how Torunaga played the council by resigning because they're such sticklers for bylaws. You said it a little sarcastically, but I think it's a point that's super relevant to the whole framework of the show. The reason they're such sticklers is because those rules protect them from each other. If they started bending and breaking those rules, they know they would be picked off by others. They're fighting a political war with Torunaga, but also with each other at the same time. I think a lot of the depth of the show comes from how it's not just two sides facing off against each other. It's many sides where alliances are muddy and will shift. It's the same reason they reject all the possible replacements, because they don't dare give another council member a new ally that could be used against them, end quote. Anyway, Dylan's email goes on, but I thought it's a great point, and I say most things sarcastically. It doesn't mean I don't actually think what I'm saying is true, you know?
David responds sarcastically to everything I say on this show. I constantly feel bad about it, but I just have to remind myself this is just how he is.
Indeed. We also got a comment at YouTube, at youtube.com/decodingtv, or at decodingtv. We're getting a lot of people are watching our Shogun recaps on YouTube. And so this is actually how a lot of people are experiencing Decoding TV, is through YouTube. One comment said about why people look down on Blackthorn in the show. This person said, quote, "It's not only about culture, but social class. Blackthorn is like one of the Beverly Hillbillies moving in with a bunch of California millionaires. He is simply a sailor like those Japanese sailors earlier in the show. His father was a poacher, a hangable fence in 1600s England. In England, the staff would have figured that ordering death for touching a bird was an exaggeration. A good old-fashioned flogging would be enough. England of 1600 could be as horrifically violent by today's standards as Japanese come across here. In some ways, the show fails because the audience can impose modern eyes on Blackthorne's attitudes that are just as inaccurate as imposing outside and modern values on 1600 Japan, end quote. So anyway, a couple great comments there about Blackthorne's class and also what 1600s England must have been like. Probably not super pleasant. Probably not like the London of today. So
that's true, because we, you know, up until this point and even through this episode, we don't get any sense of what was life like. I've kind of been waiting that like some sort of episode
like
that was going
to cut to we're in England, but like that's never happened, right?
So, right, and yeah. Maybe we'll never get that. And I think the show would be fine if it's uninterested in even exploring that. We get enough through the character here, but that's definitely worth pointing out as an acute observation that we are sort of left to, because the show does not give us that cultural context. It's very easy then to this just apply a modern lens to how we view the character, because the show doesn't give us the tools, or it doesn't have the time to want to do that itself.
Yeah. Patrick Klepek, let's talk about episode 6, Ladies of the Willow World. What did you think of this episode overall?
I think it's a really great, like deliberately quiet episode where just everything is simmering beneath the surface before, I think, much like the earthquake at the previous episode, things are about to get very, very loud in this show. It seems like this is an episode where the characters get to be with themselves, with others, before the cannons hit the fan, so to speak. It's very much a drumbeat to war. And we know where the episode ends and kind of like what we can expect from that kind of the concluding arc of the season. But I like that this show and this episode really accentuates this, constantly finds time for its characters to just exist, be with one another, and the plot moves, but it doesn't feel like the show is in stasis. It doesn't feel like it's bottling them up in order to let characters have moments. It's really, really elegant in its ability to have like this big A plot keep moving along, and these characters still have meaningful moments that as that A plot moves along, it'll give it more gravitas when the big moments occur there. And it's just this, I think this episode is a wonderful example of really moving these individual characters along and then putting them all in a position where literally anything could happen next in this show, and I would believe you. So I really just really great strong character work in here that I thoroughly enjoyed.
I think this show has hit upon the perfect formula for what David Chen wants in a show, which is having 99% of the episode being people in rooms talking about their feelings and honor, and then have at some point, one shocking act of violence.
Uh-huh.
That is basically this episode, the last episode, and the previous episode. That's basically been what the formula has been.
Yep.
And it's been a massive success each time. And so I'm loving the show. Great episode. Maybe not as good as the last episode, but still
sure.
Very, very solid. And the show continues to deliver on everything I'm looking for. But let's talk. I'll say one other thing, which is this is a show that trusts its audience. Like,
yeah,
I think actually parts of this episode were quite confusing, and we'll try to clarify it, you know, as we talk through it. But the show doesn't like really handhold or explain anything that's happening. It's just like, we're showing you a flashback. We're not going to explain who's who in the flashback or what. You're just going to have to get it. And
One thing I'll say, you know, I think Three Body Problem has a lot of issues that are, you know, endemic to like how it was built, but like,
yeah.
There, you can take greater leaps in storytelling when you are telling a show week to week, when the audience will have time to digest it, reflect mm-hmm. upon it, potentially rewatch it, listen to podcasts. Like, mm-hmm. there is a whole, I do think you can do things that are more confusing, trust your audience, knowing that if they don't get it at first glance, there are other ways for them to fill in and understand and contextualize that information that is completely shot out. I was going to say a canon, didn't mean to do that on purpose, but is abandoned when the Netflix model, the binging model, says to you, reflection, thinking about what happened, I think you should just get to the next episode. Maybe we'll figure it out there. And that, I think that influences everything down to the script level when you are building a show that way. And maybe that's not, that doesn't explain how they arrive at these, and they're just being like, hey, we're just going to trust the audience. And if it was a binge show, if it was a weekly show, maybe they don't know that while they're building it. But I think the result is the same, in which, like, when you're able to, like, have people come and listen to us talk about it, like, really break it down and help explain it for them, that is healthy and allows a show to be denser. And I think we lose something in that when shows are just force-fed to you 8 episodes at a time.
Indeed. No disagreement. All right, let's talk about what happens in the episode and spoil it. This episode begins with a flashback to 22 years ago. We meet Mariko as a young girl, and we see her become friends with Lady Ochiba, who is known as Ruri at the time. That's one of the big confusing things, is like, Lady Ochiba is the same character as Ruri, they're the same person, but yeah, they're friends when they're little. Mariko's father and Toranaga are not fans of Ruri's father, who is ruling at the time, and together they conspire to assassinate him, which paves the way for the rule of Taiko in the present day, the peaceful rule that ended right before the show began. We also see Mariko training for combat and getting married off to the Tota clan, which she's not super psyched about. I was going to just keep going, Patrick, but let me know if you have any thoughts or you want to pause on any of the stuff
One thing, maybe you remarked on it on last week's episode, but the music cue they have for Lady Ochiba is tremendous. I mean, this show has a great soundtrack. I'm sure by the end of it, it's going to be added to my rotation of just, I like to listen to television movie soundtracks when I'm writing. And this has a great one, but the menace on, go back and watch any scene where it's like, she's clearly scheming, is just like, it's so, I mean, the show just, like, it's a very subtle show at times, but then when she is on screen, they just layer on this music cue that's like, this lady sucks, or like, you know, she's up to some shit.
Does,
you know,
she?
Man?
Does she suck? I don't know that she sucks.
She has
ulterior plans for everything that's going on.
Like,
that's true.
Shows like keep an eye on this one. And it just lays it on thick. Yeah. It's just like, if you don't know, then the music cue is meant to make you understand. I just wanted to point out, because every time she is singularly on screen, I you hear that cue come up, and it's really well done.
In the present day, Toranaga is rallying the troops after many of them died in the earthquake last week. He honors Blackthorn with a fief and a hefty annual salary. Blackthorn is also made Chief Admiral of the Kanto and in charge of the Cannon Regiment, much to the chagrin of Yabushige, who decides it's time to write another will with his nephew. We get a few scenes with Toranaga this episode. Patrick Klepek, I'm going to put this out there. I think Toranaga in Shogun, kind of an asshole. Gonna just put that out there. Kind of an asshole.
I mean, a lot of characters. I mean, I think this is actually one of the huge accomplishments of this episode in general, is really complicating our thoughts on good guy, bad guy narratives with individual character. I think we are very much meant to, throughout this show, see Toranaga as a noble, heroic figure, and he may still be the character that we sort of land on and is portrayed at the show as probably the one that should, quote, come out on top. But by the end of this episode, and that's why you were fair to push back on the characterization of, like, me calling Lady Ochiba as, like, someone who, quote, sucks. I meant to just mean, like, she's menacing and calculating.
Yeah.
Because everything we learn about Toranaga, Taiko, like, everything is complicated in terms of, a land of peace and everything was good for everyone. Well, like, who's the everyone that we're talking about? And who's the piece directed at? And I think you're right. And I think it's a great part of this episode that lands you in very complicated gray areas with many, many characters on the show.
Well, that's all true. I don't disagree with any of that, Patrick. But I just think he's not really a people person.
No, he's not. Don't come to him with problems.
Yeah,
no, I don't have to. Very much, I don't have time for this shit sort of guy.
Buntaro goes to him and says, hey, I'm sorry for being a dick to Blackthorn. And Toranaga says, hey, stay away from your wife for 7 days. Meanwhile, Blackthorn tries to get out of Japan still, but Toranaga is still convinced the Portuguese are friends. And he also offers to attack ports controlled by the Catholic regents, but Toranaga is still convinced the Portuguese are friendly, so he tries to shut the whole thing down. To try to placate Blackthorn, Toranaga asks Mariko to accompany him to a brothel. So it's like, okay. Really curious what the logic is there. You know, I mean, I understand the logic. I don't think it's I think he's trying to like calm things down, but he's doing things that will arguably inflame things.
Yeah, oh. These two seem like they might be in love, and yeah. Her husband is physically assaulting her. I think the way to solve this is I think you need to personally observe this guy that you have a thing for have sex with someone else. I think that will
That's gonna solve the whole thing. And then later on in the episode, I mean, I'm skipping ahead here, but later on, he says to her, "Wait, you didn't know this whole time that the reason your dad married you off was so you could eventually take revenge on him and his family?" What? It's like, Torunaga, guy.
Read the room.
You might be a masterful military tactician, but when it comes to matters of the heart, Torunaga needs some work.
Needs better bedside manner. Gotta be honest.
Absolutely.
Or not. He seems to have gotten this far. Maybe he doesn't need it.
Mariko tries to negotiate a price for a courtesan for Blackthorn. And the bulk of the episode involves them visiting a brothel, which is also known as the Willow World. They arrive and meet Lady Kiku, who pours sake. Explains the meaning of the Willow World. She also explains what the Willow World offers while Mariko translates. She invites Blackthorn into a private room, but Mariko declines to join them. He is then delivered home the next day. And again, in these whole sequences, and I talked about it a little bit last week, it's so fascinating how the show handles translation, right? Like, Mariko is this translation layer, but she also has feelings on what is being said by all like the different parties. And so she will often apply her editorializing to the translation that is given. And that is done very powerfully in this scene at the Willow World when she translates what the courtesan is saying in the first person, right? Which is not something that she typically does. That is a editorial choice that she makes. And it kind of is a way for Mariko and Blackthorn to connect through another person's words. I don't really buy this relationship that much. I mean, Buntaro is kind of shitty, and so I get that. But, like, you know, I sense that there is a lot of affection between the two of them. But I think the show is trying to make it feel like it's this epic love story. And I don't quite feel that way. Patrick Klepek, what do you think of this whole scene at the brothel?
Yeah, totally agree on like the presentation of language front. It's just so fascinating to watch the different ways that they approach that, because it's done with such care and deliberateness, which is just not what you normally see in shows of this scale or shows dealing with multiple languages. But you know, I couldn't help be reminded of like that whole sequence you're talking about where she's speaking kind of in the first person. I mean, it's coded as a sex scene between the two of them. And I couldn't help be reminded of there's a sequence in the second season of The Bear. I'm not trying to spoil too much, but there's a scene where they're putting screws in tables that is also
when these
highly
two characters
coded.
Are screwing under a table. And
and it's highly coded as a sex scene between the two of them.
Agree to disagree.
But I think it can be read that way, right? Like, or at least there's like enormous amount of tension, whether you want to code
there's
that
there's an
or
enormous
read it
amount
as
of people on the internet that want to read it that way. I will agree with
sure.
that.
Sure. Okay. Well, David said on the other side of something, big shock. But no, it can't be that. I've got a podcast. But I think you'll agree with me that they're both like emotionally loaded. Whether you end up I think this one is very sexually coded, whether you agree with the Bear one, but they're playing in similar spaces, which is to use other like what could otherwise be a very innocuous moment between two people to just fill with an enormous amount of tension and emotion that is just wonderfully shot. I mean, I was on the edge of my seat as I was watching a sequence that is just translation. It's just localization in a way that is otherwise so perfunctory in other stories. And here is just loaded with so much subtext. And it's really a payoff for the work they've done earlier in the show to sort of gear you up for how they're going to handle this exchange between Mariko and other characters, and obviously Mariko and Blackthorn specifically. So just an exquisite scene. But I am with you. At this point, I'm less concerned about white savior narratives as much as I'm a little bummed that, like you, were clearly seemed to be headed toward some sort of sweeping love epic, however that's resolved, or whether they actually get together. And I just don't know that I fully buy the emotional connection. These are two people in extraordinary circumstances.
Yeah.
Of course they would be close. And
right.
It's possible for two people to experience sexual desire, to be close, and not necessarily fall sweepingly in love. It's sort of just a contextual situation of emotional highs, and maybe it'll end somewhere messily in between by the end of it. But if it's meant to be like, these lovers who just share a glance of a hand as he goes off to do his sacred duty to have sex with this beautiful woman. You know, that's working less for me, but it feels like such a minor qualm in a show that is otherwise operating at such a high level.
Yeah. And you know, there's that scene where she walks past him and his hand kind of brushes hers. And that's a beautiful scene. And a lot of people, I've been reading a lot of recaps that describe it as very erotic. And that's just not the vibe I'm getting from these characters. It's very tender.
I'm sorry.
There's a tenderness to it that that I also greatly appreciate, but the translation stuff was very erotic, but when he just touches her on the hand, it's a very tender moment that I appreciated. I did not find that erotic though, personally.
No, I think we're on the same page with the interpretation of both of us. That was more, you know, she tells him like, don't embarrass us.
Right.
Like, yeah. You are about
do like, your job.
this a thing is about to occur. Everyone knows the stakes, understand the stakes. And I think that was him. I felt that particular sequence was him just acknowledging to her like the emotions between right. them, and yeah. that what he was about to do felt like a violation to some degree, but he wanted to acknowledge that in some way that was expressive physically. So I think we're on the same page there.
I also really appreciate the touch that the next morning she kind of delivers him to the village. And he says something like, tell Lady Kiku, it was an incredible evening and I'm so grateful for it. And then she's like, the Anjin wishes to express his gratitude. You know, like she like plays down what he's saying and what she says to him too. And it's just like, oh, it's a very minor editorial. It's a very, you know, she took it down by like 30%. And I really appreciated that part of it. So anyway. We had a bunch of scenes in Osaka this episode as well. We learned that Ishido has taken the regent's prisoner and has locked the whole city down, claiming that there's a plot to kill the heir. Hiromatsu makes a totally badass escape, and he goes back to tell Toranaga what's going down. Hiromatsu and Toranaga discuss whether to execute Operation Crimson Sky, which I don't think is a very intricate plan. It's basically just bum-rushing Osaka Castle, as far as I can tell. We have this new Operation Crimson Sky. It's we all just run towards this place as fast as we can.
Tactician.
Toranaga's not into it at the time. Anyway, later we cut to the regents and Lady Ochiba. They're watching a play. She sees her life story dramatized and has a flashback. It turns out the Taiko could not have a son with his wife, so he had one with Lady Ochiba. Ochiba and Ishido try to recruit the actor playing the Taiko, a.k.a. Lord Ito, into being the fifth regent. They vote on Lord Ito to be the fifth regent, but Lord Sugiyama refuses to participate until the hostages are released. Ochiba is pretty pissed at the delay and explains that she's had a vendetta against Toranaga, who planned her father's murder. Lady Ochiba also reveals she had to do a lot of unmentionable shit to have the Taiko's heir, including basically taking on fate itself. Ishido then
implies she was drugged a lot as well.
Mm-hmm.
Herbs.
Ishido then confronts Sugiyama, murders all of his guys, and blames it on bandits. But yeah, we really get a better sense of Lady Ochiba's backstory this episode. And you know, Toranaga and Mariko's dad killed her dad.
Yeah.
So they really have a lot of beef that goes way back, that I assume is going to be resolved somehow in this show. And and any other thought? I think she's a really terrifying figure, and somebody who's very formidable. And she kind of came out of nowhere, you know, a couple episodes ago to be like, now she's like one of the main players. Actually, I think it was just last episode, if I recall correctly.
Yeah. I think she might have appeared very briefly in an episode prior, but she very much is like the secret end boss, like that has appeared.
Yes.
Like, you know what I mean? It's like, wow. You know, you thought this was like the enemy, but secretly behind the scenes,
right.
Lady Ochiba. And I think that makes a lot of sense for a show that is deeply rooted in history and emotions. Like, there's just, she has a stronger connection to these characters. And so for her to be kind of the final culmination of the timeline of these characters, I think despite the fact that she has had very minimal screen time, they've used her time incredibly effectively for you to understand why she will probably be the key player, one of the key players to how the end of this saga plays out. And I like the fact that she's one dimensional for a while. It's like, ooh, kind of like a Littlefinger type character, like in the background, just sort of manipulating these men. And where we arrive at here is, yes, she is stone cold, but like a tragic figure who has been manipulated by fate, circumstance in a way
that you
cannot help but feel like a deep understanding for why she is so. She is rightfully, righteously angry at about what has happened to her, what her life has been. And so to set up characters this complicated as we like head towards the end game of the show is incredibly exciting, because it's richer to not have one side to root for. It is more just, I don't know where this conflict and where these characters end up, and her included.
Yeah. One of my favorite bits is how she kind of emasculates Ishido constantly. There's this moment when she explains what her backstory is, and Ishido's like, oh, dude, you got to tell everyone about this. Like, if you tell everyone about this, like, oh man, Toranaga's so toast. And she's like, well, why would I do that? You guys can't do anything against him anyway. Like, you guys have already failed horribly at doing the basic task that I wanted, which is killing Toranaga. So why would I do any of this? Why would I endanger myself for any of this? You guys got to figure this out. So I really appreciated that part as well. But yeah, she's awesome and a great character, and looking forward to seeing how this all plays out. At the end of the episode, Toranaga learns of Sugiyama's death and decides to join forces with his half-brother to execute Operation Crimson Sky. So that is where we seem to be heading as the show barrels toward its conclusion. There's a couple of other scenes worth mentioning. We get a brief scene of the Portuguese priests. They think about turning to Toranaga as a friend, but one of the priests doesn't like Toranaga being a Minowara. And then I did just also want to re-mention that scene with Toranaga and Mariko, who Toranaga kind of drops Mariko's life purpose on her incidentally, you know, like he's like, wait, you didn't know that the whole reason you're still alive is to take revenge? You know, it's like, okay, Toranaga, let's say she didn't know, Toranaga. Is this really the best way to tell her? You know what I mean? Like by saying, hey, were you so dumb that you didn't know? Toranaga, kind of an asshole. That's kind of what I think.
I agree. I feel like that priest scene is setting up. We'll see how it all plays out. But it's like, oh, you forgot about those guys, right? Like, oh, here they're here, and they're thinking about maybe having Toranaga. And right when everything seems bleakest, the priest will somehow have something that helps them. Like when Operation Crimson Sky goes poorly. It seems like they're setting.
The night is darkest before the dawn until the priests arrive. Basically.
Yes. I don't know with what, but it does seem. Well, they are. Aren't they off training, like converted Sam? Like I'm trying to remember. I'm trying to think what they could offer to actually help Toranaga. But I feel like they will show up like at the last second with some sort of replacement for the thousands that they lost as a result of the quake.
The biggest thing we know is they have the black ship, but like we don't know how militarily that can be particularly useful at this point. But we'll see. Any other thoughts on this episode of Shogun, Patrick Lepik?
No, like I said, it feels like the show is about to get very loud. Is it 8 or 9 episodes?
10 episodes.
Episodes. Okay. We have a little bit longer than I thought. I was trying to gear myself up for...
Yeah, you thought that next week would be the penultimate episode? No.
Yeah. It has vibes like that, which is, hey, we're sort of... And it is, like, setting up for its concluding arc, but, oh, that's exciting. Like, I didn't realize it was a full 10, so... Because it feels like the show is sort of divided into chunks, and it was not going to surprise me if it was going to be a 7, 8, 9... with a lot of, because as you and I have talked about, the moments of violence have worked better than the extended scenes of combat and violence. And clearly where this show is going is to a lot of conflict. And so I'm going to be interested to see how the show handles an escalation in warfare with a show that you and I like most because of its characters talking in rooms. And so I guess that's the thought that I'm left on as we head towards this section of the show, is how will it balance that? Will it balance that? And what kind of show is it as it becomes a show about direct conflict?
Yeah. Yeah. And I'm curious what the final episodes are going to look like. This is not a show that looks cheap at all, but no. I do feel like they have saved a lot of their money for what I assume will be the next few episodes, and where we're going to have, I assume, big war scenes with hundreds of characters fighting each other. So we'll see how that all plays out, but this is a show that looks like it costs $20 million an episode.
Absolutely.
So, yeah. All right. Well, those are our thoughts on Shogun Episode 6. We'll be back with a conversation about Shogun Episode 7 next week, right here on Decoding TV. And that is going to bring us to the end of this episode of the podcast. He is Patrick Klepek. Find him at crossplay.news and at Remap Radio. I'm David Chen. Subscribe to my free newsletter at decodingeverything.com. You're listening to Decoding TV. We'll see you next week.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.